Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour, and today is Thursday, July 21st, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. Thanks to the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, you can go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner of the page, and that will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, that will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have called in and either been stepped through the worksheet process or given powerful testimonials about how the use of these tools has improved the quality of their life and relationships. We hope people will do that soon and often. Download the worksheet, read the Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book, make use of the archive shows that are specifically set up to be a tutorial for how to get the most use and benefit out of these tools. And if you do that, and you're like most people, it will generate comments, questions, answers, or testimonials. And if you have any of those you want to share with us. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. Or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. whyagain.org. Alternatively, if you're listening live, you may call us directly at 563-999-3581. And if you do that and you have a comment or question or answer or testimonial to share, please press 1 on your phone. That'll put the little icon of a hand in front of your phone number. And I'll turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code. So, what's on your mind? How are you feeling today? Have you been with us for this ride through the way of mastery? And yesterday it was just discussion about the way of mastery, and it was caller Celinda who shared with us a poem titled Awake. And what is, yesterday I put the call out for comments and questions about how the way of mastery and specifically lesson 16 is landing for you, quote, landing, close quotes. Is it making an impression on you? Is it leading you to start your own transformation journal? Is it leading you to do the practices from lesson one or lesson two? Is it making your head spin, trying to figure out how you could be in the movement that never ceases from that which never moves, etc.? All of those koans that we encountered in lesson 16. And I believe lesson 16 itself, for me anyway, is a koan from start to finish, because it's got a number of pages developed to talking about what happened before there was matter, before there was time, before there was space. And if I was sitting there in the same mindset that I had when I was in grade school and I was being required to read and recite back portions of the Baltimore Catechism, when they didn't make any sense to me, I would be saying, wait a minute, I thought you just said that we cannot know God on a previous page, and now on this page you're telling me what God wants from me and what God needs from me. And that doesn't make any sense to me. How can you say that God is unknowable and the next minute tell me you know what God thinks? That same kind of conundrum, stuckness, spinning, illogicality, spins in my mind when I read something like lesson 16. And I think it's intended to. I think that the teaching itself comes from an understanding that the conscious logical mind is just going to do what it always does. It's just going to churn and try to make sense of everything that it encounters through the perspective of its framework. It's going to try and crunch it down into something that what Michael Rice would call the 9-bit mind, the logical mind, can understand. And of course, we're trying to discuss issues, or we're trying to point at ways to get an experience of issues that go way beyond what the conscious logical mind can comprehend and what words can describe. And some would say that's a fruitless endeavor, because if you're trying to talk about things that go beyond what words can describe, you're babbling. And yet, great spiritual teachings throughout the centuries have learned that when I occupy my mind with a parable or a koan or a paradox, it engages the mind and keeps it busy and distracted, so there's a possibility for some other part of my consciousness to lead me into or guide me into or receive an experience, some would call it wisdom, that goes beyond what the conscious logical mind itself can even comprehend, much less generate. So what's happening for you as part of the audience as we do this, as we engage this thought confounding exercise? At one point we were talking about, and I kind of misspoke, and I said, we need to learn to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And then I caught myself with that silliness, and I realized it's far more accurate to say that we need to get willing to sit with the discomfort. And then at one point we had the word free fall come up. So we need to accept that, as Guy Finley would say, we all have wings that only open in midair. Meaning, if we won't take a step without demanding safety and security and certainty, we will never learn what there is beyond what our conscious logical mind can provide for us. We can't engage in the wisdom. We can't engage the intuition or the insight, the creativity, there's another word that's escaping me, but there's this, you know, this potential for knowing something experientially at a deep experiential level that goes beyond what words can describe. And so many of us who've done any kind of spiritual work or attended seminars about spirituality or had, you know, weekend intensives or 9-day intensives at Heartland with Dr. Michael Rice, so many of us have had an experience that we can't deny. We were there. It, you know, you can say it in a variety of different ways. It rocked our world. It was unlike anything we'd ever experienced before. And yet, we don't really have words for it. So, all of this work from the beginning where it says in the first lesson, the way of the heart is not the way of the intellect. All of this work is about ushering us into, whether it's a set of practices or a state of mind, where we can experience something that our conscious logical mind can't comprehend. I just a bit distracted because I just got off the phone with a gentleman trying to line up another interview for the On Your Mind podcast. And this is a gentleman who works quite closely with people who have what, you know, others would call a psychotic episode or radically different perceptions, and trying to help them understand that it's usually the result of trauma. It's not usually the result of a lack of antipsychotic medicine in their system. And that's very much like what we're talking about here. If people go to Heartland and have one of these spiritual experiences or awakenings, and then they go and try and talk about it with other people, there's sometimes it's impossible to communicate anything of value about the experience. And sometimes the people we're talking to about it get the impression that we are not sane. We're not talking sense. How could what we're trying to talk about is our experience, how could that ever happen? So, Susan Bingham, I believe.
It is.
Welcome.
Hi, Dr. Tim. Hi. So the question that comes to my mind during hearing, looking at the Webb telescope pictures and then listening to Chapter 16, being reassured that I don't have to understand this, I don't have to figure it out, I don't have to know anything, because really we need to do the way of the heart. That's the way to go, which seems such a relief. We can have an I-thou relationship with the whole universe and with our lives and not worry about understanding things. And yet what keeps hitting me is, all right, so now I feel as if I've been knocked wide open. I want to be open to things that I have maybe considered woo-woo, or, you know, I've been reading about the Actorian Federation and all these beings who are coming to help us, and listening to a couple of friends who have been, they call it protocols, they've been using other protocols and not, they don't go to regular doctors because regular doctors really are suspect. And I'm wondering, where, what's the line to be drawn between being gullible and being open? And I'm sitting here in this huge stew of not knowing and just listening to things. I suppose in the end we just have to take what we can and leave the rest and not worry about it. But I wondered if you had any thoughts about that.
About which of the 17 topics you just laid on the table?
Well, gullible versus open.
Okay, so what's your definition of gullible?
Willing to go along with things that aren't true, but how do we test them? So how do we stay open? Maybe I can't form a question. Maybe it's not askable, but...
Well, just think of it this way. So, you know, I just... My asking you how do you define gullible is not intended as a challenge. It's intended as a clarification. So, I...
Okay, well, maybe I could put the word naive in there.
Well, if you ask me, you know, how do you define gullible, I would say somebody who is continually fooled by the same kind of thing and just willingly goes along with being fooled over and over again.
Okay.
Now, that may not be everybody else's definition of gullible. And so the difference between that definition of gullible and being open is, it's like apples and oranges, right? Because I can be wide open to my experience and trying new things and also learn to be discriminatory, right? To discriminate between somebody who's ripped me off once or twice and just simply not go there and still be open to trying new things. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. That's good. I was thinking more of, you know, being foolish or being a sucker or just, yeah. There are some negative associations with the word gullible, but
yeah, it's kind of foolish in my opinion to continue to follow things from people who have demonstrated that they're not trustworthy in the past, and that's part of what, you know, would fit with my definition of gullible. But that has nothing to do with my being open to learning and trying new things. In my opinion, right? So according to my definition of...
Yeah, that's good. Trusting, maybe even unsuspecting. And, of course, if we're those things, we are vulnerable to being duped. but maybe that's a good thing.
But if I'm duped by someone, that doesn't make me gullible. By my definition, I would have to be duped by the same kind of person repeatedly, in order for me to, you know, to fit the definition of gullible in the way I'm using the term.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It brings to mind something I say quite often to people in therapy, and I was saying it to somebody just the other day that I think it even came up in the interview that I did with Amanda Acker. The idea is, anybody can do something abusive to me. I can be walking down the street and someone can throw a can at my head or hurl insults at me. I can't prevent that. At the same time that that's true, I have to actively participate in an abusive relationship.
Right.
So that's more like the gullible. If I'm actively participating in it, allowing somebody to rip me off or take advantage of me time and time again, and all they have to do is say, no, I apologize for the last time, this time I really mean it, and then I go along with it. That also ties into the idea of not having any boundaries. Right?
Right.
I have some absolutely wonderful people that I know. Some of them are fairly close friends, and they believe in stuff that I just haven't observed to be useful in my life. I have no idea whether it's true or not true. And since it doesn't have any direct impact on my life that I can discern, right, are there aliens living among us, and are there, you know, beings, spirits without bodies that are pulling the strings about what's happening in this world? I don't know the truth or the falseness of that. What works for me is to say, how can I use this directly in application to make my life more livable, more safe, more sane, more livable today? And if I can't, whichever the answer is, then I let somebody else worry about it and debate about it and take actions on it.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That sounds good.
And that's part of what I refer to as boundaries, right? It's everything I say and do that educates the people around me about what I think is important, what I think is acceptable, what I think is not acceptable. And I think that plays a little bit into what you're talking about as far as being open. I'm open to listening to people. I have good friends, and they want to talk about, you know, just, I think I mentioned it yesterday, somebody that's absolutely, we were having a conversation, and she said she believes that the Bible is literal. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I won't have any debate with her about that because I don't know the truth of it. I won't, you know, my boundaries as such tell me that I won't give up my observations about what works for me just because I have a friend who has other beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So I let her have her belief, and I respect her as much as I can, and, you know, we have whatever interactions we do. If she says to me, we can't be friends unless you believe the way I believe, then I say, okay, it's been nice knowing you. You know, we aren't friends anymore. Because that's what, you know, that's that line you've drawn in the sand, and I won't go there.
Yeah.
I'm open to having a relationship with that person. I'm open to engaging in the other nurturing and nourishing parts of that relationship. I'm not closed off to people unless they believe everything I believe. And I don't arbitrarily throw away what I have observed and what works for me just because somebody else says that's not what they believe. So it comes to my mind to ask a little bit more to clarify in what venue or what area of conversation or life interactions are you thinking about applying the word gullible? Are you talking about applying it in terms of, you know, a healthy skepticism about the allopathic medical profession, or are you thinking about applying it in terms of belief in things you can't see directly, like whether or not there are, you know, spirit beings directing this, or aliens in disguise on the planet, or what area were you
above.
Thinking about applying?
Well, we have our Zoom Mindshifter group that meets, and we've got two people from Santa Fe who belong to a very different culture than we do, and they are more prone to talking about going in alternative directions medically and otherwise. And also one of them talks about UFOs, and one of them talks about, actually, this is a local person who talks about the Actorian Federation and beings coming in. And we're trying to do worksheets, and we're trying to deal with immediate upset. But these things come into it, and I find myself going quiet because I'm listening. And I also have a layer of fear, my fear, miserable. I find that hearing about those things tells me something that I don't either want to know or I'm very afraid of about my own future. After I die, is my soul going to go out into an absolutely foreign universe? And with all these beings doing things that I am somehow afraid, yeah, there's a lot of garbage that's coming up, and it's coming up all at once. Looking at the web pictures, listening to the Way of Mastery, I feel just deeply stirred up by everything, and yet I'm in Al-Anon, and I'm feeling as if I'm stronger, setting very immediate boundaries and setting myself in an okay place when people don't do what I hope they will do so that they'll be okay, giving up the hope of people being okay, grandsons in particular. All those things, it just seems like a time of tremendous turmoil, and I don't know where to set my feet down. I guess it's the free fall thing. You mentioned that word, and that's the way it is. I guess the only comfort I have is that I come back to, and maybe this is the purpose of it all, to come back to now and to be here and to pay attention right here and to not know anything, but do my best right here, right now, which means...
Well, and to work specifically with whatever is up for you. So if you have fear, then... You do your EFT tapping, your breath work, your worksheets, your targeted journaling around your fear, and what you will discover and what you will dismantle within your thought process will be valuable. It may not be the ultimate key. It may not lead to this, you know, enlightenment and liberation, and it may not lead to getting all of the evil aliens off the planet or whatever, but it will be valuable. Because you will feel differently. You know, this is one of the things that's come up time and time again on the internet show. It has come up time and time again over the 18-plus years that we've been doing the support group. And people will want to talk about those things, and I will say, okay, I think I understand your question. I'll repeat it to them and make sure that I understand the question, and then I'll ask them, now, if I had the answer to this, can you let me know what specific difference this would make in your life today or tomorrow or next week? If I had the perfect answer to this, and if they say, well, I don't know, or, you know, I would have this or that specific benefit. If they come up with something that's a specific benefit, I will either attempt to work with them to find an answer they can accept or send them, you know, refer them to somebody who might be able to answer that for them. But if they say, it's not of practical significance in my life today, tomorrow, or next week, then I say, okay, then I'm not really interested in trying to explore that because I'm more interested in how can we help you feel better in this moment or have a better relationship with that person or get better results from the tools you're using. And that's the way I address those things. And it's been a lot of work over the years at different times. It kind of ebbs and flows, and different times we have long stretches where no one comes to the support group and tries to, quote, hijack the topic or whatever. But it is very useful for me to guard that topic space, to say to people, and I had to, we did it. I even reported about it on the internet show a couple of Tuesdays ago. People were so agitated, and the target, the external target they were using was the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court thing.
Yeah.
But we talked about it. We let them talk for about 40 minutes. And then I muted everybody and said, this is not what we're here to talk about. So I'm not saying that it's right or wrong, good or bad, a valid topic, et cetera. It's just not the topic that we're committed to talking about in this group.
Mm-hmm.
We're here to talk about the tools that might help you dismantle the upset that you feel when you talk about Roe v. Wade. Or you talk about the role of the Supreme Court in, you know, creating laws, or the role of Congress in blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So that's another aspect of this that I would call you to. If you're going to lead a group, you're essentially the gatekeeper for the process of that group and the topics.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if people keep coming back and cycling back to things that you can't have any direct experience of or any way to validate, and it's not directly related to the topic that you established the support group for, I would encourage you to feel free to redirect and be the, you know, the traffic cop, so to speak, for the group on that.
Yeah. Mhm. That's good. Yeah, I can feel sort of if somebody comes in from the Actuarian Council or Federation and says, and this actually was something I heard, I think it was Tina Louise Spaulding. I stopped listening to her because she said she got, and it wasn't the Actuarian Federation from her, I think it was Jesus, Yeshua, told her, oh, you know, go ahead and go into a crowd. You don't have to wear your mask. You don't have to, this is all, you know, it's, you have your own individual choice. And I thought, nope, I'm not buying that one. And I stopped listening to her because of that. I thought, I don't trust this anymore. But I was afraid she was making me wrong. And I see the need for worksheets in there. Being wrong seems to be a big deal.
So say that again. You were afraid she was making what?
Me wrong.
Okay.
Wrong.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
So that's right. You went right into it then. Okay, then if you have a fear about being made wrong, then you can do worksheets on that. And if you have any kind of fear come up that, you know, the Arcturians are coming and you're not going to be ready or they're going to leave without you or whatever, then you can do worksheets on that. Because once you dismantle the fear, then the world opens up differently. Your perception will be different. And that's the point of this work, for us to dismantle our negative emotional states, because we are acutely aware of how powerfully they distort our perception. And we are interested in having accurate perception. We we are interested
what
in restoring
our perception.
Any negative emotional state, any intense emotional state, whether it's ultra positive or ultra negative. Oh, Susan Bingham, I just adore you. I can't live without you. I'm going to close my practice in Illinois and move to Pennsylvania and make you love me and give up the other Tim because I'm so much a better Tim. And I'm in this love state and I'm, well, it's distorting perception. Right? It's real positive. I love it, right? I'm in this passion. I'm in this excitement. I'm in this thrill of, you know, we all, most of us have had the experience of being in love with somebody, and we do some things that we look back and we go, that was kind of silly, right? So it doesn't have to be a negative, an intense negative emotion. It can just be a really intense emotion, whether it's positive or negative. It distorts our perception. A way of mastery, not a way of mastery. Course in Miracles has a line in it where it says, we must become aware of how powerfully we distort things, the power to distort things, how does that go, from the way we want things to be, right? The distorting power of how we want things to be. And there was a classic example of this in the internet show back years ago, and Michelle was more involved, and we only had the 1 hour, and Michael and Jeannie and I would all be on together and blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, there was this ripple through the community of excitement because Jeannie and Michelle both heard me say something I never said. They heard me say that I had found a woman friend, and they were so excited because, oh, Dr. Tim, you need a woman friend, And this ripple went through the community, and I went back and I listened to the various shows, and there's nothing in there where I'm saying I have a woman friend.
Mm-hmm.
And we used it in the show as an example of the distorting power of how I want things to be. And they were excited. This was a positive thing. They thought, this is great. Dr. Tim deserves to have a relationship, et cetera. And yet, that intense emotional state within them created an experience in their perception of something that never happened in actuality.
Mm.
And so, and Dr. Michael Rice talks about the spiritual faculties. And one of the spiritual faculties is true perception. Right, mm-hmm. To be able to see the world as it actually is, to move closer and closer to what the Way of Mastery would call the shimmering radiance that lies behind all of our perceptions. There's a line in the Course in Miracles that says, perception was made as an attack on God. Perception that we create within our minds, the individual pictures that we create, is our substitute for being in direct experience or connection to the actuality of life. And Dr. Rice talks in some of his lectures about how if you could actually see the world outside of you instead of just the pictures that your mind shows you about it, if your eye was able to track the entire range of the spectrum of what we call light and the electromagnetic spectrum and the auditory acoustic spectrum, we would have a very different experience. Right? Mm. We would see a mass of energy fields nested within energy fields nested within energy fields. We wouldn't see each other or ourselves or the world around us as a physical body because it's just energy. It's energy that's always moving. It's energy that's changing moment to moment. But our senses are so limited that we don't get to see that. So that's that idea of true perception. And the more we remove the negative emotional states when we recognize them, we dismantle them. We release them, we dismantle the thought structures that we pour our mind energy into that generates those intense negative emotions or ultra-positive ones that we would consider positive, the more we dismantle that, the more we move into closer to true perception. The more we sense, we get early warning signs of things, the more we develop that, you know, intuition, that spidey sense, that tingling sense, the more we learn to trust it, the more we avoid harmful or difficult situations, because we're actively monitoring and working with the emotions we create rather than generating a belief that this emotional state or experience is caused by someone or something outside of me. So over and over again, this call to come into whatever use of tools is needed for me to take closer and closer to 100% responsibility for the emotions that I'm experiencing. And the more I'm willing to do that, the more I see of life in its entirety, closer to its true nature, and the better my life goes. But when I'm having a support group and somebody comes in and they start talking about the Arcturians and the Palladians and I start feeling all tight and tense and I think, oh, this person is ruining the group, I'm sunk, right? Because I think they're causing my upset and I think they're doing something to the group. Rather than acknowledging, oh, I'm feeling uncomfortable, I have fear or sadness or irritation up in me right now. I wonder what interpretation I'm placing on this interaction that's connected to fear or irritation or hurt or sadness from my past that's getting resonated.
Yeah, there's so much of it. Just hearing you talk about it, I've got worksheets lining up in my head. You know, Dr. Tim, you talk about the experience, the true experience of true perception, and it's almost like it would have the same qualities as having a true vision or true spiritual experience. And the one time, well, I've had a couple of times, and I've talked to them before, but when Michael Rice says, you've never loved, I think, I did then, but it wasn't personal to any one thing. It was like being infused and finding myself in a soup of it. There was no differentiation between the love in the universe that was available to everyone and the love I felt, which was universal. But I'm also thinking about the business of Michelle and Jeannie getting this idea that you had said you found a woman or something, and what they were hoping for, I imagine, is that experience of that universal, perfectly neutral love, or it isn't neutral at all, but it's not dangerous in any case. There's nothing distorted or bad about it. We get visions of that by falling in love with someone. I used to practice when I had a crush on somebody.
Let me help you clear this up a little bit, because what you're doing right now is getting caught in semantics.
Okay.
Right? And the semantics are the meanings of words and the different shades of meanings of words. And when you say falling in love with someone, Dr. Michael Rice has this body of work, and he's committed his life to it, right? So you can understand why he's so passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the core of that work is his understanding that the word love is meant for the energy of creation, the stuff you're
mm-hmm.
made of, the stuff the world is made
yeah.
of. And so it's
right.
a noun. It's the substance of life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the verb that our cultures have turned it into.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's you know, you can have a meeting of the minds, even with someone like you and Dr. Rice, if you're able to clarify the definitions. So instead of saying, I was falling into love with this person, I was learning to cherish this person. I developed a very strong affection for this person. And you won't have an argument with Dr. Rice as long as you stay away from using the word love as a verb. Because
right.
he's on a mission to carve out the use of that word and to protect it at all costs as though the entire civilized structure of humanity will dissolve if he doesn't protect the use of that word. And that's all.
I understand.
That's all that is.
Yep.
'Cause he understands mm-hmm. feeling affection and affinity for people. He understands developing the use of a word like I cherish you and to communicate the same thing that other people
mm-hmm.
were trying to communicate, but they stepped on his bag of garbage because they used this word love. And now he's triggered and he's got to be the mama bear protecting the cub and he's got to go for the jugular and all of that stuff and
mm-hmm.
stop the whole conversation and interrupt people. But that's just because he's trying to promote that body of work and keep it a special reverence for it. It doesn't mean that
mm-hmm.
he doesn't have the same kind of cherishing experiences and preferences for one person over another. He's just a person like everybody else.
Right.
So he's really not trying to tell you that you never cherished anyone or you never had a special affection for someone or that you never developed an intense personal pleasant, very pleasant relationship with somebody. He's not trying to tell you none of that's happened. He's just trying to protect the use of that word love as this noun to represent the universal energy of creation, the extension of the one mind.
I do understand that, Dr. Tim. I was trying to say something else, but I have to tell you a funny story. I have a favorite cat. It's an old, mellow, kind of curmudgeonly cat named Alex. And when I can get a hold of him, I hug him and I mush him and I tell him, Dr. Michael Rice tells me that I never loved anybody, but I love you. I just, you know,
good for you, Susan Bingham.
It's my little rebellion. But I do understand.
Yeah.
I know I understand. But I do think that kind of love, which is cherishing, which is maybe adoring or I don't know, whatever word is acceptable, leave the word love out. You get a vision of the universal, wonderful love too, but it's like we're given a taste of it through people or through whatever we love, the cat or anybody, but Michael's trying to teach us something beyond that. I don't know where I'm going with this. But anyway, I do understand what you're trying to teach me again. And that's why I tell that to the cat. It's my little teeny, I'm going to hold on to this word love and use it if only on the cat. So, yeah.
Yeah, and it exercise your free will. Way of Mastery tells us over and over again, the free will cannot be usurped. If you want to use the word love that way, go right ahead. Just be forewarned,
mm-hmm.
it's like a minefield. If you use it around Michael, he's going to interrupt the conversation and go on, you know, his verbal autocorrect, and that's okay.
I know.
The essence of what you're
right.
trying to communicate is the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't know where we were. I got off the rails. I don't know where we're going with this. If you want to take it in some direction or start reading the book.
Well, but so the essence of it is, you know, that like the really useful thing from this, from my perspective, is that it doesn't matter what topic somebody brings up, whether they want to talk about you're misusing the word love or you better believe that there are lizard people among us or you're not right in your political beliefs. It doesn't matter what the topic is. If I find
right.
myself experiencing an intense emotion, I am best served taking a breath, turning the focus inside myself, and asking myself, how am I creating this emotion? And if it doesn't immediately dissipate, using some of the tools like the reality management worksheet, the mind goal management sheet, the mind shifter targeted journaling tool, and waiting to speak or act to whatever degree is feasible in my life in that moment until after I have dismantled the roots of what is generating that distorting, intense emotion in me.
Yep.
And the further I move toward being able to take 100% responsibility for the emotion that I'm creating, to whatever degree that's possible, the better my life gets, the better my experience of life gets. And it's going to be that way because when I do that, I will want nothing from people. And as Guy Finley says, if you don't want something from someone, they can't lie to you, which brings us right back to that gullible thing. So if I do this, I will dismantle that part of me that you were referring to earlier that's subject to becoming gullible. I will see clearly when somebody has ulterior motives for whatever they want from me, and I'll be able to make a more informed decision about whether or not I comply. Does that make sense?
It makes sense all the way up until the last thing you said. There are, I understand about as soon as I feel anything, it's like Walzak, okay, here I am. What am I feeling? It's my stuff. Bingo. You're already dealing with your own stuff, and it's all about your stuff. And nothing, things are triggers, but they're not responsible for their the quality of triggering.
Right.
That's your business. But then
right.
You said something right at the end, and I didn't get it.
Well, it's about the idea of if I'm seeing things clearly, I will see when someone is trying to fool me or take advantage of me, and then I'm not as gullible.
You think so?
Yes.
I don't know if that's true.
Okay.
I
try it out. See what happens.
I'll think about that. Try it out. Okay.
Guy Finley says,
if I've done my work, if I've totally done my work and got rid of my reactions and given up goals and stuff, I will see clearly enough to know if something is bullshit or not. I don't think so.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, to a much greater degree than is true otherwise.
Okay.
Yeah.
You step back. Okay, to a greater degree. But
I'm not saying that's the answer to everything. I'm just saying that just take the one line from Guy Finley, which I think is so useful. If you don't want something from someone, they can't lie to you. Just let that sink in for a bit. Let your mind chew with all of the different permutations of that. And then watch how that starts to unfold in your life when you cancel your goals for anyone or anything to do this, that, or the other. It changes your ability to be fooled by them, because you'll see more clearly because your perception is not being distorted by the power of the way you want things to be. That's that line that we were talking about from the Course in Miracles before. We must come to understand the distorting power of the way we want things to be.
Okay, I want to go into this a second, and I'm going to go back to Tina Louise Spalding. If she's telling me something that I really think is wrong, but she's telling me that Yeshua told her that, I desperately want to be on Yeshua's side, and I either change my belief or I stop listening to her.
Okay, I've got another option for you.
Okay, good.
I have another option for you. I mean, that's black and white. That's off and on. That's good and bad. That's a judgment thing. I either do this or I stop listening to her. I've got an alternative for you. Just the one that just popped into my head was, you definitely want to be on Yeshua's side, right? Isn't that what you said? Okay.
Yep.
So go into prayer and meditation and ask Yeshua. Get out of your head. Get out of trying to be right or wrong. Get out of trying to make Tina Louise Spaulding right or wrong. And then go into yourself, go into your own connection to spirit, source, whatever. And that's exactly what the Way of Mastery is trying to get us to do. From the very first lesson where it says the way of the heart is not the way of the intellect, don't argue the point with Tina Louise Spaulding. Feel the energy of that we talked about, and you have all of this fear and all of this resistance come up in you. Use the worksheets to dismantle the fear and dismantle the resistance. Go into your own prayer and meditation. Ask your inner core, source, spirit, Ruka Dakucha, Yeshua, whatever you want, and come to your own conclusions. And let her have her opinion, and you have yours. It's okay. And from that perspective, then if you decide to keep listening to her because much of what she's offering seems useful and in line with and nurturing for you, then you do that. And if you say, that just has really shifted my perception about her and the value of what she's promoting, and then you choose not to listen to it, that's okay too. But you're doing it from a space other than the fear.
Yeah. You just made me realize that I did the equivalent of killing the messenger by just shutting her down. Or I had a client once, she who wasn't very intelligent, didn't really understand doing the work, and I didn't have the tools, but I was trying to teach her how she could deal with her anger toward a person that she was upset by. And she said, I said, you could practice, you know how we use bataka bats? Do you remember the bataka bats years ago? Bats. We used to, I mean, talk about a tool that didn't help anything. But I told her, you know, when you feel that angry, you can hit a pillow. And she said, why? I have to ask, why should I hit a pillow when I can hit him? And I just never.
Well, for one, it's less jail time.
I didn't quite how to navigate that question. Anyway, your point is.
That just reminds me of the movie where you know the mobster is in analysis, and so the therapist says hit the pillow, and the mobster pulls out a gun and shoots the pillow five times. Says, you know what? I do feel better.
Well, and it does help, you know, for a minute. Yeah, that was the whole idea. Feel good for 5 minutes. It's
right, that's the
like
drug.
Indulging. Yep, that's the drug. I love it
right,
when Michael
like
says anger is an addiction.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Dr. Tim, you've done it again, as you always say to me. Thank you for the good laugh.
Thank you for the comments, the questions, and it's just really useful stuff. It's bringing us right back to the core, which is, you know, if I'm thinking or speaking as though someone or something outside of me is causing my emotions, I'm off the track. That's the definition Michael uses for codependence, and it's what all these tools are about, to help me step in to dismantle the negative emotions before I spend too much time thinking, speaking, or acting when that stuff is active in my mind. So blessings.
Right.
I will mute you so you can listen in. Great talking to you as usual. And I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love. Everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Good conversation. Enjoyed that.
You're very welcome and deserving. Have a great show.
Thank you. Let's welcome everybody to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. Today is Thursday, July the 21st, 2022, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And while we're waiting on Michael to get dialed in, I'm going to turn on Susan's microphone. I saw your hand go down and back up. How are you doing today? Good conversation with Dr. Tim, by the way.
I know. It really, it's funny. It just helps to laugh about it. It's all so funny. And anyway, but I want to know how you are. Your voice sounds very different. It sounds just fragile. How are you feeling?
I am better today. I'm still not going to run any races, but I was able to take a shower and wash and dry my hair without being totally fatigued.
Good work.
Yeah, I'm still coughing and my chest is still a little bit tight, but at least I'm not as fatigued. But I still don't have like a lot of energy. If I go, you know, up and down steps a few times or whatever, I feel like I really need to stay on. But I'm just taking it easy, stayed in bed most of yesterday, and just taking it slow. But we were talking, we were sitting at breakfast a few minutes ago and said, you know, it rained pretty hard last night. And we did not go out and harvest from the garden yesterday, and we haven't today yet. And so things are probably really ramping up out there. So this afternoon we may take a slow walk up to the garden and check it out. Of course, Michael's on about day 11 of his, so he's pretty much on the other side of it, and I think I'm getting there.
Oh, good. Well, I think we ought to send you a fold-away teeny little cot that you can roll right up to your computer so you can run meetings sideways.
Yeah, right. I think I heard Michael join us.
Good.
You did. I'm here. How are you, young lady?
I'm okay. I'm processing, as always, but that's good. Yeah, I got your poster, the drug thing, and I've left it strategically placed in my study in hopes that a certain person may accidentally see it. I'm not going to be waving it in front of his face.
Right.
But anyway, yeah. Things are going well. He's been coming around the house, and the Al-Anon, you know, the codependency work you do made it very good, easy to understand what Al-Anon is telling us. But the amount of letting go of all kinds of goals, they're right up in the face. And then I say, okay, you know, if he wants to sleep all day, he can sleep all day. I'm not getting him up. I'm not doing a plan at all. I'm just letting everything happen as it's happening because he is physically safe. And that's all I can do right now without getting into being a parent.
Right. Well, we're holding the space as you hold the space and see what unfolds.
Thanks. Yeah.
Has an invitation into a simple worksheet happened yet?
No, long. Oh. You have no idea.
Okay.
There's a lot of distance between the possibility of that.
How is that?
There's just, I can feel it. The best discussions we have are when he introduces things, and he is saying things. And then I may pick up on it. But if I introduce things, it's like I'm lecturing and correcting, and there's a big shutdown that happens.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure your guidance will be absolutely perfect to bring the highest and best outcome possible.
I hope so. It's just a feeling that I get. Like, don't go there now. Not time yet. But yesterday, I can give you an example. He said, will you come with me to buy a cable for my guitar? And I need to get gas. Well, I had things to do. And I said, why don't you just take off and go ahead and get those things? I'll tell you where they are, and you can put it in your GPS.
The reason I said that is because he'll want me to pay for things, and I have been paying for things, and I'm not paying for things now, unless there are chores done around. So that was a win. So he didn't go. He didn't say anything, but he didn't go. And then last night I said, you know what? I'm cooking two different recipes. I need a lot of chopping done. Would you be my sous chef? And this will be one of the things that helps you earn your allowance. And he looked at me and sort of rolled his eyes and said, I don't feel like it. And instead of pushing or doing anything or even feeling badly, I said, oh, okay, that's fine. And I did it myself. And he came and went as he wished, and he didn't do anything. But he's not getting his allowance, and he hasn't asked for it either. This sort of thing. I mean, it's that's how it is.
Challenges.
Yeah.
Well, holding you both in a blessing, the three of you in a blessing.
Thank you. And he also said, well, why don't you just give me the money? And I said, Boone, I think that would be about the meanest thing I could possibly do to you. It would be the least helpful for you to get on your feet and be the grown-up that you're telling me you are. And so there's this silence, and then he says, well, I don't feel much like a grown-up. And I said, you bawled me out yesterday saying you're making me into a kid, and I'm not a kid, I'm a grown-up. And I said, I'm honoring that big time, and I'm going to keep honoring
it. Good for you.
Because you're right about that.
Sounds like a good response.
Thanks. I think so, too. I feel good about it.
Yeah, nice. Awesome.
You got a ways to go, though.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling good in that kind of a space, that you're staying connected is perhaps one of the biggest gifts you could give.
I hope so. And then last night it was, you know, he hadn't been out at all, and I said, come walk with us. And he said, I don't feel like it. So I said, okay. And that was the end of that. So I think he'll begin to trust us if he knows we're not going to push. And then maybe he'll come out of his shell. I'm hoping so. But that's a goal. Have to look out for that.
Well, you can always cancel that one.
Yep.
Get the energy move.
Yeah.
All right. You have a blessed one.
You too.
All right. Lots of love.
Thanks. All right. We don't have another hand up. I'm not sure if you and Michael Teddy were going to continue with your conversation. He is on the switchboard, but he doesn't have his hand up.
Yeah, he said it'd be a little later in the show before he'll be able to engage in conversation. So,
okay. Then
we'll
it's
wait
all
till
yours.
He puts his hand up, and then it's all mine. Well, welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here. And we move to the next level of understanding these awesome tools. That teaches exactly what forgiveness is and how to engage in that process.
I don't know if you're talking. You went quiet.
I did go quiet. I was just looking at a note here. So I was looking at a topic I was going to touch into. So we've been talking about the power of goals and the way that the mind operates in building its perception. And if someone, you know, understanding, you know, getting deeper and deeper into the understanding of this whole process of perception and how the mind is building the world that we see. You know, we can stand in front of 1,000 objects, and if we have no recognition of what any of those objects are, then our brain doesn't generate anything that makes sense. You know, if one of them is a cup, I can go, oh, well, there's a cup. But if I have no brain cells for anything that's being presented or anything that's in front of me, then my brain won't generate a construct, a perceptual construct that makes sense out of what's in front of me. And one of the keys that keeps the mind generating content is the goals that drive that content. And we can be in front of a particular object of attention or a particular situation. And if we have a goal that distorts what that object is that we're looking at, then our minds literally, I mean, it's literally a state of hypnosis. Our minds can show us or generate a construct, a perceptual view of something that is virtually irrelevant based on what it is we think we're looking at, you know, in the state of hypnosis. And if you look at it, the ancients said transcend, and what they were in essence saying was put an end to the state of trance, get out of the state of hypnosis. And hypnosis is basically the uncritical acceptance of an idea. And when we uncritically accept an idea about a circumstance or a situation, then that idea becomes the source of the construct of our minds rather than the object that we're actually looking at, or the situation, the circumstance. And so our goals become a major key in driving the perceptual output of the mind. There's a wonderful line in the Course in Miracles that says, you must be aware of the distorting power of the way you want it to be. And oftentimes people have goals that go way, way, way back in their lives, a goal for something that they've always wanted, but they're in a circumstance where that result is an impossibility. And by holding on to a goal for that which is an impossibility to happen, we can keep ourselves in suspense. We can keep ourselves in trauma and torture ourselves by wanting an outcome that isn't physically possible. You know, let's say I've got COVID today, and I say, well, I want to go out and run for 2 miles. Well, at this point, the fatigue in my body would not carry me very far if I got up and started running. So if I sit here and go, I want to run it, 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 and at this point it's a physical impossibility, everything in my mind that I hold from any time in my life where I wanted something to be a certain way, it wasn't that way, and I went into any form of sadness or grief or loss or pain or trauma or hostility or fear, then my mind is going to tend to keep me on that cycle. And I keep going, oh, if it would just be, if only it would be this, if only it would be this way, if only it would be, if only, if only, if only. And people keep torturing themselves when all they have to do is cancel the goal. And sometimes that goal might need to be canceled 1,000 times. You know, it's been hanging around in the mind maybe for generations. And so that goal maybe is going to have to be canceled 1,000 times over before the mind finally settles and lets go of, I want this to be different. Acceptance of what is, oftentimes the mind's disturbance finally can quiet down and the distorting power of that goal disappear. And all of a sudden, I'll find the circumstance that yesterday was very untenable, I had a lot of upset and disturbance about it, or my mind tells me my upset and disturbance is about it. But the truth is my upset is about the content of my mind, and the goal finally canceled allows my mind to let loose of that upset, to be free of it, and I might find something wonderful about the circumstance that I'm in. My mind is free then of the distortions introduced by the goal and the pain of not wanting, and I find myself in a different space by simply letting go of the way I want it to be. And the way I want it to be can be a wonderful motivator as well. You know, motivation, there's the story about the the guy that that works across a graveyard from where he lives, and he works night shift, and usually he just cuts across the graveyard, you know, the moon is out, and he's been through it 1,000 times. It saves him from walking all the way around, so saves him quite a walk. And so one particular night, he's on his way home, you know, walking through the graveyard, and the moon is dull, is not much light to see by, and unbeknownst to him, there's a fresh grave that's been dug, and he falls into it. And it's so deep, he tries to climb out, and he can't get out. And, you know, he knows the guys who work there, so he decides, well, I'm just going to go to sleep, you know, so he lays his head back and goes into rest. You know, they'll get me out in the morning. It's no big deal. There's no sense struggling. Well, along about 4 in the morning, a drunk comes stumbling through the same graveyard, falls into the same hole. And this guy is asleep and, you know, fellow almost falls on top of him, wakes him up. And, you know, he's a little bit shaken at first, and he finally realizes this guy's trying to climb out, and he's already tried it. And it's like, hey, buddy, now that you're in here, you can't get out. But the drunk did. It's called motivation. And when there is a wide space between the way I perceive it to be and the way I want it to be, that space, the differential between that becomes the degree of motivation. And so if there's something that is reasonable for me to create and my mind sees that that's not the way it is at all, setting a goal to create differently is one of the things that can bring forward my creative power, my creative ability. And again, if I load that goal in my mind and that goal resonates some form of hostility or fear, then by canceling that goal, I can free my mind of that hostility or fear, the distortion that's introduced by the hostility or fear, and the removal, the accessing the parts of the mind that hold hostility and fear, and accessing those parts of the mind in the presence of active love is what dissolves pain, trauma, rage, sadness, grief, hatred, vengeance, that assists in removing those things. So it's if you look at the worksheet process, you know, step-by-step process, the step just before you engage in the core of forgiveness, you step into a space of conscious, active, present love and holding that space for yourself. And or if you're not able to hold that space for yourself, then you ask for support. You know, you've got someone that you're working with, you've got a partner, you've got someone who will hold that space for you. And where perhaps it's not possible for you to hold that space for yourself, you've got support. You've got someone who does that for you. And when the part of the mind that distorts our perception is allowed to come forward directly in the presence of active love, it is the presence of active love that creates a dissolution of that pain or trauma. And it's the removal or the transmutation of that energy, transmutation meaning the change, that is actually where the forgiveness itself occurs. There are steps that lead up to steps and that will bring that forgiveness process around, but the actual release of the actual shift in the energy of the pain or trauma is where the forgiveness itself actually occurs. The action of forgiveness is what brings about that result. And it's interesting, I oftentimes see people who will talk about forgiveness and they'll talk about the result as though the result is the act of forgiveness. And they end up, I was reading a post from someone this morning on Facebook, and they were talking about forgiveness is this, 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 and this. And they were talking about the results that they wanted from forgiveness, but not engaging in the actual process of forgiveness. So wondering why it wasn't working. So the core of forgiveness is that if my mind is generating some form of hostility or fear, it's generating that hostility or fear because that's the content of my mind. And I've put a goal in my mind. I've loaded a goal. I've set the desire to accomplish something as a commitment. And that goal links to or resonates to that hostility or fear. And the power of canceling the goal, you know, in the Aramaic language, the word forgive is shebag. It means to cancel. When I'm willing to cancel that goal, the perception created as a result of holding that goal collapses. And when it collapses, that's when the underlying energy that needs to be exposed to love is able to surface in the presence of love. And when the two meet, that's where the dissolution, the actual energetic dynamic of forgiveness happens. So that's the core of the process. And if you're not engaging in it, you're certainly welcome to go to our website, whyagain.org. And in the upper left-hand corner, there's a link that says Start Here. And if you click that link, it'll start walking you through the whole process of forgiveness. You can download the worksheets from the website. You can do the forgiveness process right there on the website. Or you can go to your app store on your phone and type in the words Heartland, one word, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Aramaic, forgiveness. And you're looking at the world's only forgiveness app. And you can do that step-by-step forgiveness process right there on your phone. And if you choose to, when you complete a worksheet, you can print that worksheet and save it to your phone, and you've got a record of it. And one of the things that I've discovered over the years is that keeping old worksheets and coming back around to them, you know, on some sort of a regular basis, you know, maybe reviewing what you've done in the last year once a year, and oftentimes there'll be new insights and new gifts that come from work that you've done. So keeping a record of it can be helpful. And so if that leaves anyone with any thoughts or questions, if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you in our control panel, the call-in number is 563-999-3581. Call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly on your phone. And then if you push 1, we're having a conversation. And it would be delightful to hear from you. How can we support you? What's on your mind? 563-999-3581. Push 1 and we'll have a conversation. Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up? My throat's still a little bit froggy. Or anybody in the phone queue?
No, there are no hands up, no questions in the chat room. We have 36 minutes, so somebody press 1.
Lots of time for conversation. One of the things, if you're in the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing group, you know, our Tuesday night group was a little short. We were missing a couple of folks, and because Jeannie had COVID, we kind of cut it a little short. So we've decided to add an additional session on Saturday morning. So if you are part of that, make a note. And at 11 o'clock Eastern time, our standard Still Point Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing time, we're going to add an extra session in. So at 11 o'clock, put that on your calendar. Jeannie, check your email. Jeannie had sent out a Zoom link so that you can be part of that conversation, and we'll kind of fill in for what we missed on Tuesday evening, for what we were with a couple of folks who couldn't make it.
I was just getting ready to say it will be like our Tuesday night processing. It will not be another Saturday breathwork.
Right. Yeah, it will be a session for question and answers, processing, and so we'll open the space for that at 11 o'clock on Tuesday, or on Saturday, pardon me, once again. So just to fill in for the fact that we were a little deficient with the fact that with COVID going on Tuesday night, we kind of called it early. So There were a couple of folks who couldn't attend, so we decided to fill in with an additional session. So please mark it on your calendar and come and play if you're in the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing Club. And if you're out there in listener land, let's say hello. How can we support you? What's on your mind? Your question about the worksheet, about the commitment? Yes.
Michael now has his hand up.
Oh, cool. So, let's say hello to the young man.
770, you're on the air.
Hey, sir, appreciate
hello.
Your conversations.
Hello.
How do you be?
Doing well, thank you. I'm glad to
awesome.
Hear by your voices that you all are doing better.
We are. We're coming up the other
wonderful.
Side of it.
Wonderful. Glad to hear, and I bet you all are too.
Yes. Yes, definitely. It has not been the most fun experience, but seems like it's, for me at this stage anyway, it's producing some nice benefit in my feet. And actually, I'm experiencing a little more. I was out this morning running some errands. I'm past the isolation time, although I did wear a mask while I was out. But so I was doing some literal running around. And it seems like something has opened on a new level in my feet and legs. So I'm enjoying that shift in energy. It's subtle, but still very definitive. So I'm assuming that's COVID's gift this time around. Last time its gift was for my lungs. So
it does have some gifts for us.
Well, my take is people who, you know, get really sick and die from COVID aren't really dying from COVID, but COVID, you know, I mean, when you think of everything as energy, you know, if I have my TV set tuned to channel 4, channel 2, 3, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, all the way up to 1,000, all those other channels are there. But they can't express through my TV a quote-unquote virus, which is not alive. You know, they talk about killing a virus and can't kill something that isn't alive. All that we've got is a piece of genetic information, much as information coming in through a TV tuner is just information. But there's got to be a tuning mechanism to receive it. So there's got to be something for COVID to attach to. And so I think it's the energetic patterns that we're holding on to that literally, you know, if you go back to the ancient scriptures, they say, with man, death began. We made the energy up that creates this thing called death. And so my, you know, from a physics point of view, what makes sense to me and what my experience was last time around was that it's got to have something to attach to, and it's what I've made up, the energetic patterns I've made up that it exacerbates in me to create these symptoms. And if I'm willing to work with that, and if I'm conscious that I'm doing my work, as opposed to trying to push it down, you know, do nothing but drug it and avoid it, if I'm embracing it, if I'm willing to move through it, then it's going to give me the opportunity to, you know, it kind of acts like a mind shifter that stirs things, that brings something up that needs to be healed. And if we're doing that work, then what we get from it is a gift as opposed to destruction. Otherwise, it simply exacerbates the destruction we're already doing to ourselves. So I think it's offering us an upgrade if we're willing to participate with it and engage it, then go with the upgrade.
But why everyone doesn't get it, because it's got to match that frequency, is that basically
exactly
what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if I've got 100 television sets in the room and there are, I don't even know, 1,000 television stations, the only station that can come through any one of the television sets is one that I've got the tuner set for. And, of course, we're kind of all in this together, and we've got this collective, You know, if you go to the opening words in the book of John, where it doesn't say in the beginning was the Word and the Word became flesh, but rather says in the beginning was the mind energy and the mind energy became flesh. If we're engaging in mind energy that doesn't belong, we're engaging in disease. And, you know, again, in the Aramaic, the word that describes an energy that doesn't belong in the system is the word sin. It's an archery term, simply means off the mark. So if there's all kinds of, if there are all kinds of energetic patterns that are off the mark that I'm holding on to, you know, that I bought from, you know, television, cultural programming, education, whatever, if I have all kinds of energetic patterns that are off the mark, it's been acquired in common with many, many millions of people, then anyone who carries those patterns is going to be vulnerable to that energetic stimulus that they call a virus. Now, am I going to take responsibility for what it moves in me? Am I going to pay attention? Am I going to strengthen my immunity? Am I going to move through whatever comes forward? I've worked with several people who, one of the things they found when they got COVID was that some of their darkest fears, some of their darkest thoughts were right there in their faces. And I think that's exactly what it does. It attaches to the darkest. And if someone stays in that suppress mode and allows that intensified energy to continue to move, then it creates symptoms and ultimately, potentially, death. On the other hand, if it moves my darkest thoughts and I'm willing to be with, process through, forgive my darkest thoughts, then it's given me an opportunity to upgrade my health by showing me what I hold that doesn't belong in my system and give me the opportunity to work through it. You know, I assume that in the videos you've watched the one, you know, on with in concert with the, at least I think we sent it to you, the video on mind shifters, and that a mind shifter is a thought about an issue in one's life around which there are negative thoughts, and it's the opportunity to surface, process, and release the negative thought. To me, the virus is like a mind shifter. It's going to show us what we're holding on to. If there's nothing being held on to, then there's nothing to be shown, and there aren't going to be symptoms as a result of it. Because the whole appearance of what we call form and chemistry and organs, you know, if we listen to Einstein, he says, on such things as matter, we have been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibrations have been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses, there is no matter. There is no material world, according to Einstein. It's an energetic world.
And that takes us right
so
back
what
to
energy
the first statement of John.
Yes, exactly.
Mind energy became flesh. That's
yep.
Powerful.
Mm. And if it's become my flesh, but it doesn't belong in my flesh, it's, again, sin. It's energy that's off the mark. I better be doing something about processing through it and letting go of it. And how much of that is there in each of our structures? Well, if you stop and think about it, everybody in your bloodline and mine that's over 120 is already dead. So in our genes, there's already quite a bit of death energy. You look at the scriptures, and they talk about, look to the lives of the fathers, for ours are but a shadow of theirs upon the earth. How often do we just play out the patterns of the generation within the culture, within the family system, instead of waking up, realizing, oh, this feeling that I have of rage at my, you know, sister, that's my rage. I wonder how many people in the family system rage has sickened and killed over the generations. Rage is unlike human life. It does not belong in this energy structure called the body that was built to incarnate and to honor love. So am I willing, am I going to just play my rage out and pretend that it's my sister's fault? Or am I going to own my rage, process through it, and forgive it? The mind energy that generates the thing we call rage or sadness or, you know, whatever it is. And our emotions give us, are the warning signal to tell us when our process is off base.
So within family structures, Michael, is it safe to say this? I thought just came to me, and I have wondered, what is it within family structures that we trigger each other so easily within that structure? And I think you just explained the answer to this is the our ancestors that were off the mark have passed that on to us in the family structure, and so it's so familiar to us because each of those, that DNA, my sister has, my brother has, and it's a big, big familiar circle to us.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Okay. Wow.
Yes.
That was a light bulb moment there for me. That's
beautiful. And if
sad, but
if
beautiful.
If our family has responded to those energies in a certain way, and that's what's been modeled for us since childhood, and that's what's resident in our genes, then we're going to tend to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do what is familiar, family, familiar. And the power person dynamic steps in there. And so, you know, when Yeshua talks about, you know, he makes a whole series of promises to he or she that overcomes, what is it that we need to overcome? We need to overcome the familiar, the family dynamics of hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, blame, whatever it is. And literally confronting those energies, develop the willingness, the skill, and the ability to open to the point where we can literally reach into our genes and remove those things from our structures, removing death from the family system.
So in doing that, would, I think we touched on this the other day, affect my children and grandchildren?
Absolutely.
Doing that with me right now. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. When you do that, my take, it be kind of like you can't demand that your children or your grandchildren change that dynamic, but when you're standing close by and you've walked through that energy holding to active present love, you've opened an energy window. It's like, you know, sometimes I resolve, boy, I'm never going to do this again. And I mean it, and I'm never going to do it again. But then the circumstances are right. You know, the circumstances are familiar. And those old dynamics resonate and take over and run my mind and run my mouth. Over time, as I choose to forgive each time, what I see happening with the forgiveness process is that it weakens those energy fields and the reinforcement of them. So it's as though for my children and my grandchildren, what I'm willing to face, what I'm willing to process through, I open a kind of an energy window for them to make it easier for them to do it. It's like when a parent models hate and rage for a child, child tends to learn hate and rage. When the parent models forgiveness for a child, when the parent models responsibility, ownership, and the ability to move through something, then that modeling makes it easier for the child to do the same. And of course, when we're realizing that this is all energy and these are energy fields, that child doesn't have to be in proximity of me doing it to energetically get the message that the family system has changed. Any more than, you know, I need to move my TV over to the other side of town where the television station is when the tuner changes its signal. My television changes its picture when the signal being sent out by the TV set or the TV station changes. And we're each resonating, radiating energy fields, both sending and receiving all the time. And as I clean something up, it opens the energy window for others in the family system to go, oh, this could be different, rather than, well, this is familiar and this is just what I do when under this kind of stress. So it opens an energy window for shift to happen in those other family members.
So this work actually will break the cycle of where the Bible says the sins or off the mark of the ancestors to the third and fourth generation. This is going to break that cycle.
Do you remember what comes after that statement? The sins of the fathers we pass the into three and four generations. Do you remember what the next line is?
Michael, not offhand.
It says, so here's the Creator speaking to the individual. The sins of the fathers will be passed yea into three and four generations of those who hate me. Here's the Creator saying, if you are separated from active present love, then you don't have me as an advisor. The only advisor you've got are your generational patterns and your generational insanity. So if dad and dad's dad and dad's dad's dad did this, that's the energetic pattern reinforced in you. It's in your genes. The circumstances are right to resonate it, and there's your advisor. And if you hate me, and hate there in Aramaic is not, the word isn't as in a love-hate relationship, it's those who are separated from me. So if you're separated from the voice of love, then the only advisor you've got is what the generations did. So it's going to be passed from generation to generation to generation. When one opens and truly honors love, the Creator, then the option to move to the, in the direction of love, which then means the dissolution of those generational patterns, becomes an option. But not to those who think God's some fearful thing and that the beginning of wisdom is fear of God, which fear excludes love. And so one now hates God when they're in fear of God because fear is a separating energy. But rather when you realize that the Creator, you know, the key word in the scriptures for the Creator is love. You know, you go to the Old Testament and people had made up this horrific punishing. You know, he tells people to go slaughter this, you know, neighboring village, every man, woman, child, and animal in a neighboring village. This hateful, vicious figure. Yeshua comes along and says, hey, guys, mistake, 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 error, error, error. I got a new story for you. Our Father is love, and it is his good pleasure to give us everything. That one back there was the mind of man projecting its own fear and rage into the Creator and making up stories about the Creator that weren't true. The Creator is love. Actually, I'm working on a new book. Yeah, I'm working on a new book, and in that book, it's kind of like my story between myself and Richard, only this time it's between a character and Yeshua. And one of the stories that I tell is about Abraham, and you know the character's questioning, why would the Creator tell Abraham to sacrifice, to kill his own son? What? That doesn't make any sense. And in it, I explain, well, actually, you know, the voice that Abraham thought was God was this parental voice that wanted control, that wanted the best of the best for themselves, was selfish and controlling. And so Abraham's got a voice in his head that he thinks is God's voice that says, you know, take your son out, cut his throat, and sacrifice him to me. And, you know, the character is saying to Yeshua, that doesn't mean, you know, why would God do that? And Yeshua says, no. Abraham's listening to the voice that he's projected into his brain's image of God. It's not God at all. And then he explains, and it's kind of, you know, the way I have Yeshua explaining it to him, it's like, you know, God is wiping his brow. I caught Abraham and got him to stop paying attention to that silly voice in his head that required sacrifice. In fact, if you go back and read about my words, I say, I abhor sacrifice. I don't want that blood in my nose. It's horrible. And so it's like God's wiping his brow in relief. Whew. I caught Abraham before he did that terrible thing to his son. I was able to stop it. Yeshua brings a new understanding that the Creator is a parent who's here to nurture and support us and care for us, not this fearsome, punishing, hellfire and brimstone mind.
Yes, back. I thank you for explaining about hate, because that was an immediate question I had as you first were explaining. But you hit that, and I'm understanding. Could you shed some light on why 3 and 4 generations, what your thought is, why that was chosen? Because if I'm recalling, I've heard you speak about many generations back, times certain number, and all that trauma that we have accumulated in our DNA. So just trying to bring some reasoning around the numbers.
Yeah, well, you know, you maybe remember from high school that Mendel did some experiments with peas and genetically altering peas. And if there were genetic inclinations that he could breed out of a pea in producing the next generation, if he could keep that particular trait from expressing for 4 generations, it would disappear from the future generations of that strain that he had bred. And so it seems that if an energetic dynamic isn't reinforced in that 3 to 4 generation period, it kind of naturally dies away. And we have many inclinations, you know, if you think of 4 generations in your bloodline or mine, and I go back to 4 generations before me, where did my great-great-great-great-grandfather get his inclinations, his energetic dynamics, but from the previous 4 generations, who got them from the previous 4 generations, who got them from. So my take is that we have we could perhaps say the muted inclination of everything that's happened in every generation in our bloodline. The things that have been reinforced and played out in the previous 4 generations will tend to be at a whole different level of amplitude or intensity in us, and therefore be more likely to play out. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And as you were speaking, it came to my mind, I'm not recalling the doctor's name. There was a doctor in the 1930s, that experimented with a dental infection with rabbits. And I believe he did that for 4 generations of rabbits to, maybe all wrong there, but in remembering, but it's kind of along the same lines, seeing what's amplified and what that result is.
Yeah, energetically, if it's not reinforced, it will tend to decay. It will tend to fade away. Doesn't mean it's totally and completely disappeared, but it tends to weaken in its intensity. And so the things that have been reinforced and played out in, you know, the immediate generations will have more of a tendency to express than the things that, you know, perhaps stopped expressing 10 generations ago. It doesn't mean there's no pattern in us for it. But if the pattern hasn't been reinforced recently, there's less chance that it's going to come into expression.
Okay. So it's still there, just not likely to express.
Until my take, you know, and to me this is the genius of the forgiveness process from the Aramaic, is that if my mind is showing me a picture that is accompanied by some form of hostility or fear, then I recognize that that perceptual construct is being driven by a goal. You know, you'll notice that, you know, unless you're a generally miserable person, you're pretty happy with most everybody as long as they're fulfilling the goals you have for them. And the time when things get tough and tight and crazy is when someone isn't fulfilling the goal you have for them. So Yeshua comes up with this brilliant process of forgiveness. And the way it's done is anytime there's pained content in the mind, you look at the goal you hold that's driving the mind to use that particular content, reinforcing that particular content. And in the Aramaic language, the word forgive is shebag. They translated it to forgive, but it actually means to cancel. So when I cancel the goal that's driving my mind to use, let's say, this frustration that I say, yeah, every time I get around my brother, I'm so frustrated. Like my brother could possibly cause frustration inside of me. But what is it that's really driving the frustration? Well, if my brother would only, you know, just stop and listen to me and hear the intelligence I'm offering him. So what's forgiveness going to look like in that situation? I cancel my need for my brother to hear the intelligence in the offering that I'm giving him. When I cancel that, the generated construct, the perceptual construct of my mind that puts my frustration into my brain's image of my brother collapses inside of me, because that's where it's coming from. And when it collapses into the root of the pain that my physiology is generating. In step four of the worksheet, you'll notice what you do is you step into conscious, active, present love. Before you cancel the goal, you identify the goal that's driving the pain to perception. You bring love present, then you cancel the goal. And with love present and that goal collapsing that perception drops into the underlying or unconscious root of the frustration that needs to be healed. And when that frustration comes forward in the presence of love, it dissolves. That's how it's removed from the generations. That's how it's removed from my physiology. And that removal is the forgiveness process. Here's how it's done. I have a pain perception. I have an object of attention. The goal I hold for my object of attention is, and the more precisely I identify the goal, the more completely the pained perception that's generated by my mind collapses in on itself. The deeper it collapses in on itself, the deeper the access I have to the genetic energy that creates this frustration and brought forward in the presence of active love, the mind of God, now I'm no longer separated from God. I'm no longer, you know, hate of God, but or love, but rather I'm in relationship with love, creates the dissolution of that underlying dynamic until it is truly relieved from generations. I use an example, and it's not a pleasant one, but it's a visualization that everybody has. And everybody watched the towers go down on 9/11. They watched these buildings that dropped into their own footprint at free fall speed. Now, of course, that's an impossibility, but we watched it happen, or supposedly. But if you use that visualization of the structure, perceptual construct, dropping into its own footprint, when you cancel a goal, that's what happens to your reality, to the perceptual, the pained perception that you hold. And that's how you get access to the underlying energy that needs to be healed. That's how you return your mind to the moment where the original offending event, an energetic pattern, happened. And that's how love, how that pattern is exposed to active love. And it's the active presence of love that dissolves that pattern. I can remember back, 30 or so years ago, in intensives, I'd watch stuff happen that was just, you'd say that's miraculous, beyond comprehension that changed. And it was like, what is it? Gee, there were 40 people in the room and this one person got a major shift, major opening and healing, and everybody else is still running around with the same stuff. What happened that occurred, that change happened for that individual? And what I was shown was that two things have to happen for healing to occur. Love has to be conscious, active, and present. And love, not mamby-pamby, sappy, I love you kind of thing that passes as love in our culture. Not sexual athletics, not putting your head on a chopping block and sacrificing yourself. But the actual presence of love is alive at that moment, no longer separated from God, no longer hate, those who hate me, but rather love enters the space in an active form. And so that's condition one that needs to be met. And condition two is something that's been in hiding, something that's been in the unconscious or the desert comes forward. And when the two meet, there's the dissolution of the energy that's off the mark, the energy that's creating the pain and the trauma. 35 years full-time working with Yeshua's forgiveness work to understand that that's what was happening.
So powerful.
I cancel a goal, pain perception collapses in on itself. I know I have access to the underlying original offending energy, which might be 10 generations old. Love is present. The original offending energy comes forward, and it dissolves in the presence of love. And that's the actual forgiveness process.
Wow.
Breathing with you.
Beautiful.
And we're down to the last minute. So we'll continue this conversation tomorrow if appropriate. Keep
yes.
note of your questions, the refinements. I can hear your mind clicking through and getting different levels of comprehension. And so any refinements, let's keep the conversation going. I think it's wonderful for everybody to be able to lend an ear to and move things forward.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Michael, for the time, for the platform on which to do this. It's been most enlightening, and we look forward to it tomorrow.
All right, sir. You have a blessed one. Lots of love and blessings, everybody.
Too.
Have the best year yet. of your eternal lives. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.